Today on Against the Grain. As the world rushes headlong into the climate emergency, what might a liberatory approach look like that would avert ecological disaster while making another world possible? Drew Pendergrass and Troy Vitese have laid out one vision for eco-socialism that takes on the difficult question of how to plan society in a radically different way. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Much of our imaginings of the future, even on the left, are enshrouded in pessimism. Few visions exist of a more optimistic, even utopian path forward. In half-Earth socialism, a plan to save the future from extinction, climate change, and pandemics, which is published by Verso, Drew Pendergrass and Troy Vitese set out to rectify that. Pendergrass is a PhD student in environmental engineering at Harvard. His current research uses satellite aircraft and surface observations of the environment to correct supercomputer models of the atmosphere. And Vitese is an environmental historian and fellow at the European University Institute, where he's affiliated with the Robert Schuman Center for Advanced Studies. Let me begin with you, Troy. Half-Earth socialism starts with an imagining of our world from the future, looking back from 2047. Of course, there have been many such imaginings from the future. William Morris's News from Nowhere comes to mind. But this is your attempt to picture what our world might be like in 2047, if we stay on the course of market-based solutions to the climate crisis, in fact, even a greener market-based approach than what we have today. In broad brushstrokes, what might that look like?
So it's not necessarily business as usual. I mean, if anything, we're trying to be very generous to mainstream environmentalists. We're saying even if they achieve many of their goals and they take power in many countries and so forth, it still won't be enough to solve the environmental crisis. So we imagine in the 2020s, suddenly green parties take power in lots of places and they impose cap and trade on lots of carbon emission sources. They are able to actually double energy efficiency gains in that period over the next 25 years. Electric cars become more mainstream and make up a large share of the total fleet of cars, about 30%. And maybe lab meat becomes more popular and makes some kind of breakthroughs into the market as well. So we are saying all these things happen, but it still won't be enough to actually achieve any real reduction of carbon emissions or deforestation that's related to the meat industry especially, because overall these markets will have grown. And it won't be enough to actually impose absolute restrictions. So we actually relied on some forecasts from various oil companies and the IEA and other organizations like that. And they say, okay, even if electric cars become quite popular, there's still more cars overall. And also people will be using petroleum for aviation and for plastics and all that. So oil production will actually be higher in 25 years than it is now, like substantially higher. We also don't think that these cap and trade programs would actually be enough to impose any kind of real restrictions, because you need to have a really high price. The IPCC reports estimate the price should be in the hundreds or even thousands of dollars per ton over the next few decades. And right now, in most places, it's around $20 or $30 a ton. And maybe if it even goes a double, so like $50, it's still nothing. And just for some kind of comparison, or to put that into perspective, it's the difference between like a few cents being added to a gallon at the pump versus several dollars or tens of dollars per gallon. So it's a huge difference, and that's just probably not going to happen with moderate environmentalism. And then many other things will probably go wrong in the next 25 years, like geoengineering, which is the technique of trying to directly control the climatic system by injecting aerosols into the atmosphere to reflect sunlight and cool down the planet. That will probably be imposed probably in the next 10 or 20 years. There'd be great inequality. We imagine a trillionaire emerging sometime over the next decade or two. We also imagine a very large pandemic. Something like avian flu will also take place. So none of these things are really wild, outrageous guesses, right? I mean, if anything, we're trying to be somewhat cautious, but it still paints a really dire picture of what society will be like in 2047, which is having lots of warming, having a dangerous geoengineering program, having more pandemics, inequality, and things like that. And we chose the year 2047 because that's the centennial of the founding of the neoliberal movement at the Mont Pelerin Society in 1947. So we're kind of imagining a century of neoliberalism, and that's what we're looking forward to. So we need to, if the left needs to ally with environmentalists and other movements to imagine a new future.
And I want to ask you more about the way you imagine all of that. But let's just stay with geoengineering for a moment more, Troy, because this is something that is seriously a possibility into the future if more effective means of slowing the climate crisis don't get forced through. And I wonder if you could describe it in more detail and what it really would mean for the environmental movement if one of the main ways that capital and the state address the climate crisis by blocking the sun's rays.
Sure. I'll say one more point about, I guess, how we're imagining the future, and that relates to your question about geoengineering. And that is, you know, the book's purpose in general is we need to have big debates over our future, right? And I think us imagining what this dystopian future looks like, hopefully we'll get people to really take the environmental crisis more seriously and imagine alternatives. And then, and also a big influence on the book was the scholar of neoliberalism, someone named Philip Murawski, and his final chapter, one of his books, looks at the climate crisis and how neoliberals will deal with the climate crisis. And it assumes it would be denial, then useless cap and trade programs, and then geoengineering as a way to protect the market from regulation by the government. And that inspired our attempt to write our own future. But geoengineering is basically a suit of different technologies. I mean, it can also include direct air capture, where you try to take carbon directly from the atmosphere, which of course is much harder to do because it's, you know, there's relatively little carbon in the air relative to everything else in the air. It's only 400 parts per million, right? And then you also have BECCS, which is like bioenergy and carbon capture. You have iron fertilization, where you try to create algae blooms to hopefully suck up carbon when you try to create diatoms, which is a kind of algae. So there's many different ways to do it. I can go on, but these technologies are, you know, there's probably like a relationship between the riskiness of the technology and the cost. So perhaps the more moderate forms of geoengineering in some ways are more expensive, right? Or they take up a lot of land, for instance. And then the ones that are easiest to do, such as solar radiation management, they are extremely cheap. So it only costs about a couple billion dollars a year to have a fleet of high-flying planes that are able to put aerosols into the atmosphere. And those aerosols could be sulfur, it could be diamonds, it could be a nano, you know, engineered particle. People are still debating what they would actually use. But its effects are trying to mimic what happens when a volcano erupts. So when there's a large eruption, it puts dust into the atmosphere, and that will block out the sun partially and cool things down. So what we're trying to say is that I think most environmentalists, they portray the environmental crisis as a problem that is so bad, it would actually threaten humanity with extinction. So people have books such as like 6 degrees of warming and imagines everyone's just living at the North Pole or whatever it is, and most people have died and so forth. And I think that that's a dangerous way to approach this problem, because it's exaggerating the threat at some level. And I think although climate change is very bad, once you have a bunch of scientists, entrepreneurs who say that, oh, I can cool things down with this new technology, then people will, if anything, like welcome them as heroes in a way. And they won't see that there's been a network of right-wing philanthropists and also, you know, conservative think tanks who have been trying to delay action on climate for decades to allow this commercial solution to take effect. So we're going to, again, welcome this very dangerous technology as our savior. And what's really bad about, I think, the left right now is they're so keen on technical solutions and embracing technology and having some kind of accelerationist solution to any problem that they actually are quite uncritical when it comes to geoengineering. And the dangers, and Drew can speak better to this than I can, but the dangers of geoengineering are manifold. And that's basically because we're acting in a very complex system that we do not fully understand, and we can't model these things well or experiment these effects very well. So because it's so complex, we can only act. And geoengineers themselves say this. They just want to start doing it. And things could happen such as damaging the ozone layer. It'll probably turn the sky white, so no more blue skies. Also big blood red sunsets. It could also weaken the monsoon. It could cause many droughts. It would definitely affect precipitation. And who knows what's going to happen to poor countries of the world that maybe will be affected. Because one could assume that the geoengineers would try to fine-tune it to benefit the global north rather than the global south. And even geoengineers compare this technology to nuclear weapons in terms of their sheer scale and how much they affect the world and how much danger they represent. But also because once you start geoengineering, there's the danger of great powers disagreeing about the program and actually engaging in nuclear war if they shoot down, let's say, one of these fleets. So it's an extremely dangerous technology. We should be talking about this all the time.
And presumably, too, if you block out the rays of the sun, solar power as an option becomes derailed. Drew Pendergrass, you write in the book, Half Earth Socialism, about precisely the point that Troy just touched on, which is the difficulty in making models for how nature is going to be, how nature will act under various circumstances. How do you make sense of the difficulties in trying to understand, map, model nature as a dynamic force?
Yeah, one of the key arguments of the book is that, as Troy was pointing out, this proposal of geoengineering is essentially a way of making the climate safe for markets. We can consciously interfere and shape the climate and nature so that the markets can go on and do their mysterious work outside of human interference. This is kind of a key neoliberal postulate, is that the markets are this information processing machine, and any interference from the outside will disturb the ghosts in the machine, and we should not interfere. And so we counter in the book that we should instead be planning something that's a human creation, the economy, something that's recently produced, in order to restrain the economy's impact on the climate so that we don't have to engineer something that we don't understand. It's an argument about controlling something that's a human creation, a recent human creation, rather than nature. Control the economy, not nature. So to your point about modeling the natural world, modeling climate, I mean, my day job is making models of the atmosphere, models of climate, models of air quality. And these models are super useful, right? Like the physics of climate have been understood for a long time, although there's lots of uncertainties about things like clouds, feedbacks with ice, the dynamics of ice sheets. All these things are uncertain. The biosphere, all these things are uncertain, but we can make pretty good estimates of how climate will respond to various forcings. But the point is that there is a difference between knowing something enough to make models with some uncertainty estimates about it and knowing something enough to control it, like an air conditioner or something like that. That's the kind of the key argument of the book. It's not that science doesn't know things and that science isn't helpful and that science isn't necessary for a future society and learning about nature is not vital, but that learning enough to control it is always going to be beyond our grasp, and that we should instead be humble and accept that we're always learning, and that this incredibly complex world around us is always going to remain partially beyond our grasp. And so we shouldn't try and turn the thermostat as if it's something that we can fully.
Drew Pendergrass is my guest. He's a PhD student in environmental engineering at Harvard and co-author with Troy Vitese of Half Earth Socialism, a plan to save the future from extinction, climate change, and pandemics. That's published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So as Troy was saying, 1947, the year of this gathering of those who would launch what we think of as neoliberalism, champions of free market capitalism, is a sort of touchstone for your book. And these thinkers gathered in the mid-20th century at a time of defeat for the unfettered market. And yet they waged a war of ideas that ultimately culminated in the world that we live in today, this world of neoliberalism. Drew, how do you see the importance of ideas, radical ideas, in struggles over the kind of world that we're in now and the kind of world we might fight for?
So our book is proudly utopian. You know, the introductory, you know, quotes are all kind of talking about the idea of utopias. And we marshaled this thinker named Otto Neurath, who's from the turn of the century Vienna, one of these strange polymaths. And he was involved in planning this very short-lived experiment in socialist democracy in Germany during the German Revolution called the Bavarian Republic. And he has a concept called scientific utopia. And his idea with scientific utopia is that governance in a socialist society should include the economy, right? We should control the economy. It's a major part of our lives. And the way that you could do that is by having multiple possible visions of the future, different blueprints for the future on offer. And these blueprints would offer kind of a full picture, a full accounting of all the different consequences of a potential future, right? We might have a future where we work more and have more stuff, and this has more of an impact on the environment, and this leads to a certain standard of living, but it also has certain labor practices, certain other impacts. So you can kind of look at the whole for that potential future and compare it to another future where there's maybe different work, different material throughput, different lives. And we can look at these all at once and debate and then figure out what scientific utopia we'd want to go with, and then, you know, maybe have a vote or something and then work to implement that together. So the idea of scientific utopia we found very inspiring, because often discussions about the environmental crisis or economic programs or many things are very piecemeal, right? Like we might talk about an electric car or something like this, different forms of technology, but not looking at the whole. Like, what would be the implications of, say, rolling out bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, transforming a large part of the world into managed plantations where we grow trees and then burn them and capture the carbon to reduce the carbon in the atmosphere while supplying electricity? What would be the consequences of this? Like, what would be the implications on the food system, right? Could we eat as much meat if we did that? So just trying to look at the whole is one of the main projects of the book. So the book works on two levels. One is proposing this idea of scientific utopias as a way of thinking about the environmental crisis as a whole in all of its facets and all of its consequences and potential methods to solve it. And then the other aspect of the book is our specific scientific utopia, our specific proposal, which I imagine we'll talk about later. But to your question about ideas, we think ideas really matter, because we think that if we're only looking at things piecemeal, or we're only looking at things from this partial perspective without thinking about how they fit together, then we kind of fail to reckon with the scale of the environmental crisis and its demands and the demands of solving it on, everything about our lives. Like the IPCC loves to say Things like solving climate change will require a total change in every aspect of society. Thinking about things like if we want a livable climate, then we might have to give up meat so that we can have enough land to do things like carbon sequestration, and also things like biodiversity loss. How can we avert biodiversity loss? So the book's engagement with ideas is very serious. We engage with neoliberals very deeply because they care about ideas too, and we kind of fashion our socialism in contrast with their ideas. But we also think that this sort of lively debate of whole scientific utopias will be a way forward, a more fruitful way to discuss the environmental crisis and potential solutions.
Right, and part of the argument that you make in Half Earth Socialism is that there's been, in many ways, a void on the left of ideas around how society might be structured, and that has played a role in the left being incapable of seizing moments where the crises of capitalism are more visible to the larger public. And we're going to get to that and certainly talk in depth about the kind of scientific utopia that you all have in mind. But Troy Vitese, I wonder if you could first take us back to the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, and the way that three thinkers viewed nature in terms of trying to make sense of how we view and should view nature now. That is the philosopher Hegel, Parson Thomas Malthus, and Edward Jenner, who popularized the vaccine for smallpox. How did each of these three men see the relationship of humanity to the rest of nature?
What we found is there, in a single year, in 1798, you have these three thinkers that you mentioned that did not know each other and were not writing in response to each other's works, but they actually formed this unusual conversation that we have created in retrospect. And that is a conversation between three different ways of viewing the environment and the relationship between humans and nature. And these are not the only three ways of thinking about the environment, but they, I would say, are the three perhaps most influential. So the first would be Malthus, who probably your listeners know, and especially the ones who are involved in environmentalist causes. And Malthus was writing a critique of William Godwin's work from a few years before, which outlined a perfectible society, so a utopia that was very much in line with what was happening with the French Revolution and the Enlightenment in that period, this idea that humans will eventually create a society where everyone can be happy and enlightened and equality was possible. And Malthus was saying that utopia is impossible because people will always have more children when their living standards improve, when they can afford it, basically. And then they will reach a limit from what the land can produce, and then population will fall, what he calls is a positive check in the form of famine and disease and war and so forth, and it will return the population down. So there can be no improvement in living standards in the long term. So this is obviously a pretty bleak point of view, and this becomes very important in many ways. I mean, lots of ecological fields like population demography and so forth draws on Malthus. He actually became the first professor of political economy anywhere. So his effect on economics is extremely important. He actually was friends with Ricardo, for instance. And then he also became a large influence on the environmental movement, especially in the 1960s and 70s, where a lot of books such as Limits to Growth or The Population Bomb are dealing with, or are trying to reuse this Malthusian logic for the environmental problems of that period. And they would say that overpopulation is the ultimate source of environmental problems, and therefore to solve these problems, we have to reduce population. And these environmentalists could be pretty brutal at times. They would suggest stop sending food aid to poor countries, because the idea was if you let people starve now, that's a better thing than helping people and then letting more people starve in the future, which is exactly what Malthus would say about the poor laws to help poor people in Britain in the early 19th century. So this is a problem in many ways. I mean, in the book, we say that lots of environmentalists are Malthusian. You know, perhaps they're not as brutal as some Malthusians can be, such as someone like Garrett Hardin, who's famous for his Tragedy of the Commons parable. And he was actually a white nationalist, and very closely linked to pretty unsavory groups. And then one can go on and on about listing how environmentalists have engaged in pretty conservative politics and made allies with racist groups and have alienated themselves from the global south, from you know, minorities within the United States and many other places. So, and they have also, because they see population as the problem, they have no critique of capitalism, right? So there's many things wrong with this worldview, but this is an important worldview that emerges in that period in 1798. The second worldview that I can talk about is Hegel's. And Hegel was actually working on theology at the time, and he was trying to understand different ways these ancient people of the Bible related to nature. And then he started to come up with this idea called the humanization of nature. And that is this idea that humans see nature initially as this dominant, dangerous alien force that controls their lives. As in, you know, you pray to, you know, the gods to give you rain, and you're totally at the mercy of the elements. And then over time, as people work the land and change it and turn, you know, a forest into a field, or a river into a canal and so forth, then they see their own human consciousness in the landscape, and they become reconciled to nature. And so the end of history is when all of nature has been humanized. So that is Hegel's approach, and that very much influenced Marxism. And the idea is, like, the Marxist utopia is also one that has a totally humanized nature. And the problem with that is, what Drew was saying before, is that, you know, we can't fully know nature. So when we act in something we don't know, it often causes problems. I mean, it causes, there's unexpected consequences. And I think zoonotic disease is probably the best example of this. Like, pretty much any intervention into an ecosystem can cause a new disease to emerge, be it, you know, deforestation, or have a livestock industry, or even suburbs, or animal experimentation. All of these things have the potential for creating diseases. And all diseases that humans have are relatively recent, right? They only date over the last 10,000 years. Before that, when we didn't have any domesticated animals, we didn't have contagious diseases like smallpox or influenza and so forth. And what happened with Hegel was that a new disease emerged in the late 18th century when the East India Company started colonizing part of South Asia, and that actually affected this ecosystem, where cholera, this bacterium, no longer had its ordinary prey but started to adapt itself to human bodies. And then you have an epidemic that leads to a cholera outbreak. It crosses Eurasia and kills Hegel. So our point is, the humanization of nature, you know, is necessary to some degree, but it should always be restrained and carried out with humility, rather than seeking this goal that a lot of Marxists still have, that we need to totally dominate nature to create this abundance that will lead to, you know, paradise on earth. So we're very much pushing against that narrative. And the last person I'll briefly talk about is Jenner, as you were saying. And Jenner, you know, was a scientist in that period, and he actually became accepted into the Royal Society for his work on cuckoos. He was a very good bird watcher. And there actually was a whole debate in the 19th century about whether cuckoos were parasitic birds or not. And Marx and Engels both make fun of people who were interested in this question. But so there are some strange connections between these three thinkers, but not in the way you would expect. And so Jenner, he realizes that milkmaids did not get smallpox because they were infected by something called cowpox, a related disease, which gave them some immunity. So he experimented and carried out these vaccines, which were, you know, very effective. But he also writes about this history of where disease comes from. And it's really amazing that he's able to do this, because people don't know what viruses or bacteria are in 1798. But he says that diseases come from us being too close to nature, right? It comes from us being too close to animals. And therefore, you know, we extrapolate that a proper solution to zoonotic disease is to create a more distance between us and the natural world in some ways. And that means abolishing, you know, livestock. It means, you know, rewilding much of the world and so forth. So we see Jenner as what we call an ecological skeptic, right? So he's quite different from these other two thinkers. And that's a position we embrace in the rest of the book.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today, I'm speaking with the authors of Half Earth Socialism, a plan to save the future from extinction, climate change, and pandemics. That's published by Verso. Troy Vitese is an environmental historian. He's a fellow at the European University Institute. I'm also joined by Drew Pendergrass. He is a PhD student in environmental engineering at Harvard University. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Drew, Troy had been tracing for us some of the currents that really we still grapple with when we think of nature, that these currents that have persisted for centuries about how humans picture their relationship with nature and or the nature that's outside of them. And I wanted to ask you about mainstream environmentalism, how you understand of what sort of lineage it follows in, and the problems that you see with mainstream environmentalism solutions to the climate crisis, which include bioenergy, carbon capture and sequestration, and nuclear power.
So in the book, we trace what we call demi-utopias, or like kind of half solutions to the environmental crisis. And we kind of point out where we find them inadequate. So the one of the first ones that we trace is this idea of bioenergy with carbon capture and sequestration. And the idea with this technology is that you grow a plantation of trees. The trees take up carbon as they grow. You cut down the trees and you burn them for electricity. You capture the carbon emitted when you burn the trees, and then you bury that carbon underground. And so it's a negative emission source of electricity. Now, the interesting thing about this technology is not that there's a big activist group or something like that pushing for it, but because it's a very convenient artifact that shows up in climate models when we're talking about, you know, modeling the future. So in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, like the 1.5 degrees Celsius report from a few years ago on keeping warming within 1.5 degrees Celsius relative to the pre-industrial baseline, one of the findings of this report is that if we don't cut emissions very rapidly in the coming decades, but we want to keep to this you know, pretty ambitious target of 1.5 degrees, then you need to start growing these BECCS plantations. You know, one of the reports, you know, has like a three Indias worth of land basically goes into these plantations to have enough negative emissions to offset all of the massive emissions we have from our very slow decarbonization process. So this is not going to happen, basically, is our argument. It's incredibly expensive. It's incredibly destructive to biodiversity. It's also not clear it would work. Most carbon on land is not stored in trees, but in the soil. So if you disturb the soil, it might end up emitting more carbon than you're taking up from BECCS. So it ends up being kind of a convenient accounting trick that, you know, shows up in some of these models because it can pretty easily convert, you know, carbon into the ground. To counter this, we think that you're just not going to get that much negative emissions. So you have to rely on reducing the burning of fossil fuels, basically. You have to rely on rewilding to draw down some of that carbon, but it's not going to be as much as these models predict. Another kind of solution on offer that we talk about is nuclear power. So some environmentalists, kind of counter to the environmental tradition, are proposing building very large numbers of nuclear power plants in the coming years to help with this transition away from burning fossil fuels. But there are lots of problems with this that we point out. We don't think it's this cure-all that it sometimes seems to have a reputation of being. For one thing, nuclear power plants take a very long time to build. There are some technologies out there that are kind of touted as solving this problem, like fast breeder reactors might be able to use waste material to generate electricity. But we talk about some of the problems with fast breeders. They tend to catch fire because they use liquid sodium as a coolant. So we're skeptical that this will be a great solution. And so ultimately, we just don't think that nuclear power will be this cure-all that it's sometimes touted as. Plus, if you're building a lot of nuclear plants, your uranium ore will degrade in quality and it'll require more energy and more environmental impact to refine lower quality ores. And that also kind of counts against you. And then the third one is the half-earth itself. So the book's title is Half Earth Socialism, and we take the idea of half earth from this concept popularized by E.O. Wilson, the naturalist. And Wilson's proposal is that half of the earth should be set aside for nature. He thinks in basically nature preserves. And we point out, as Troy has already talked about when he was talking about Malthus, the pretty nasty history of a certain kind of conservation, a certain kind of environmentalism, right? If you're influenced by Malthus and this overpopulation idea, it can get pretty racist really fast. And these and conservation has lots of colonial and racist legacies. So we think that we should care about averting biodiversity loss. The whole idea of the half earth is that the biodiversity crisis, like we're living in the sixth mass extinction in Earth's history, that the cause of this is principally land use change, like converting habitats into new uses so that the tremendous biodiversity on Earth can't survive in that environment. So to address the biodiversity crisis, which we think is absolutely necessary, we do need to, you know, have land set aside for non-human animals, non-human species. But this needs to be done sensitively and we think in a democratic socialist way. That's why we call the book Half Earth Socialism. It needs to be a discussion with everyone where we kind of balance these trade-offs together and think about like what sacrifices we might have to make to set aside land for nature. And a spoiler alert, one of the sacrifices will probably be abolishing the livestock industry. Agriculture takes up half of habitable land, and of that, livestock is about 77%, 80% of agriculture, even though it produces a very small number of calories. It's just a very land-hungry form of farming, and you also have to grow plants to feed to the animals, which is very inefficient. So this is just a very irrational way of using our land, and if we want to do this half-earth concept, we'll have to take that trade-off. We also point out that indigenous stewardship has very good results, right? Like has much more biodiversity than other forms of land, sequesters twice as much carbon. There was a recent study that found indigenous managed lands sequester twice as much carbon as other forms of land management. So the half-earth should be allied with land back movements, indigenous sovereignty movements, that sort of thing. So we take the idea of the half-earth and try and get the good part out and expunge the bad part. So this is our engagement with this environmental thought. There's a lot of these half solutions out there, but we try and kind of cohere things, take what we like, discard what we don't like, and cohere a more full picture of what a solution could be.
Drew, I'd like to ask you more about the details of how you all see an eco-socialism that is up for the challenge of addressing the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis. But I wanted to step back and ask you, returning to the theme of how any society should take into account the vast complexity of nature, how might a vision for eco-socialism, how would it be able to figure out these questions without using the market, which of course is the reigning model for more than half a century?
Yeah, so one of the things that we try and do in this book is there's lots of books that, you know, detail a critique of the environmental crisis and a critique of capitalism even. And then they end with sort of hand waving about the need to go beyond capitalism or the need to, you know, change the way we think. Sometimes a lot of books end And we were not satisfied with these endings. We wanted to offer something that people could sink their teeth into and respond to, either, you know, positively, negatively, or modify it with their own ideas. And so we wanted to imagine a world without markets. So we this Otto Neurath character that I was talking about earlier, who had this idea of scientific utopia as a way of bringing the democracy into the economy, he has this critique of what he calls pseudo-rationality. And the idea of pseudo-rationality is that if you have any sort of society that optimizes itself by one metric, like profits, right, calculated in money, then you'll get outcomes that might look on the surface to be rational, but actually are completely irrational, right? We could, you know, as a firm, I'm rationally maximizing my profits, and then look outside, we now have biodiversity loss and climate change, right? Like I may have acted rationally, but the outcome is irrational. No one wants it. No one wants this crisis. So Neurath instead proposes that we should think about things as a whole. So this is where the idea of scientific utopia comes in, where we think about all the different ramifications of different futures, and then we can decide between them on the basis of this more full understanding of different possible ways we could live. And then we can debate and decide there. So we want to propose, you know, a potential way of coordinating a complex society without the market. And so this is the third chapter of the book. We talk about this, and we draw on a huge number of sources to imagine how one might democratically coordinate and plan an economy. We start with talking about this very interesting figure from the Soviet Union named Leonid Kantorovich, who was a mathematician who devised this algorithm called linear programming, which is familiar to anyone who works on optimization. It's all over the place in science and in management and in many fields. But his the idea of this method is it allows you to, you know, solve an optimization problem with constraints. So you can, you know, maximize the production of plywood subject to, like, what kind of machines you have, what kind of wood do you have. That was the original problem that he was trying to solve. But he sees that it can be scaled up to the Soviet Union as a whole, rather than relying on this kind of ad hoc, you know, planning apparatus that was very inefficient. Maybe there was a way to more rationally allocate production. But, you know, he's stymied by politics, by lots of forces. We argue that the lack of democracy in the Soviet Union was part of what prevented him from doing this reform. Even this sort of technocratic reform that he proposes would have taken power away from the central planning authority, so they would not be able to allow that in their interest of preserving their power. So we use this example, but we point out that this sort of linear programming method is probably not sufficient to plan an economy. So we draw on another tradition from the 1970s in Chile. There was a democratic socialist experiment where President Salvador Allende is elected on a platform to transition Chile to socialism peacefully. And so he starts nationalizing firms. There's a movement from the ground up that's supporting this. And the question arises, how do we coordinate all these firms that we're nationalizing in a way that's consistent with the principles of democratic socialism, with the principles of the Chilean socialist movement? And so they bring in Stafford Beer, this cybernetic planner, like this a guy who's trying to think about how do you plan a very complex system, you know, without markets, basically. So they come up with this sort of model that's really interesting, and it's under this label of Project Cybersyn. And the idea of Project Cybersyn is using this kind of distributed system of management where, you know, workers manage the factories, but they need to, you know, have coordination between factories. So there's an additional level of coordination on that. And there's longer term planning. And this is facilitated by a computer and by a network of these telex machines, these very primitive communication machines. And we find this experiment to be really interesting because it doesn't rely on very complicated technology. It's more of a model of how do you coordinate a complex system that needs some direction, right? Like we need to have a direction where we want the economy to go, but we also want to make sure that, you know, we have local autonomy, we have workers controlling their own workplaces. And so how do we have this balance between like an overall direction, right? If we're trying to solve the climate crisis, we do need to have an overall direction, but we want to have this autonomy as well. And so we also draw on other experiments in ecological planning and in Siberia, and we even draw on climate science, which climate science and weather forecasts rely on big models that are updated by data from around the world in this very dynamic way. And these sorts of systems seem interesting. And they also have these built-in methods of downscaling, is what often called, where you have a coarser model for a larger domain, and then you zoom in with more fine resolution in a smaller domain. And this might be useful if you have an economic system where we have some broad goals at a large scale, and then we see what the implications would be in more detail at more local levels of government. So I went very fast there. Obviously, we engage with a lot of these ideas in the book, but the idea is, going through this sort of forgotten history of economic democracy, of going out of, using markets as the way we coordinate the economy, instead try and coordinate it ourselves for our own ends. And point out that this is possible and that there are experiments there that we can learn from with lessons both positive and negative. And that it's worth putting out there as a point of debate that we don't have to rely on markets that have led us blindly into this ecological crisis, and instead can draw on an alternative.
Troy, in the time we have left, I wanted to ask you, in terms of kind of moving from these wider notions of how such a society might work to what life might look like on a daily basis in an eco-social society of the kind that you are imagining.
So we have a fourth chapter in the book, and that is actually fictional. And this is drawing on the utopian tradition where, of course, lots of these books, such as News from Nowhere, or Looking Backward, or one can go on and on. I mean, Ursula Le Guin as well. I mean, where they use fiction to imagine what life might be like in this society. And I think what's funny about this is that, when we were writing the book, we maybe thought it was going to be a scientific and historical book, but it quickly became, pulled in many of these other directions, and we realized you really needed to have fiction in it to imagine this society. And what happens is that we have a character that wakes up from 2022 and imagines, and wakes up in this world of 2047, where a revolution has perhaps taken place about a dozen years before, and people are living in different arrangements. Some people are living together in dorms, some people have apartments, but they live with their families and all that. And then people are able to choose between different jobs. Their jobs aren't also anything that defines them as a person. They have other interests. They maybe will take up other skills as well. And there'll be a negotiation between, I guess, the difficulty or the dirtiness of a job versus other things such as more leisure time and so forth. And then people will also be participating in planning as well. So what we're really interested in is not having a technocratic approach to this society. We don't want to have a bunch of experts to say this is what eco-socialism is. And also Neurath was very much a critic of technocracy, because he didn't think there really was anything as like a scientific method, right? Science is rather people coming up with different approaches to understand the world, and this is something that will never reflect reality perfectly, but it would always be remade. And he compares it to sailors being on a ship that they're constantly fixing up and changing, using pieces of the ship. So this is what socialist democracy also has to be like, as in we have to be consciously learning and changing how we relate to each other and relate to the natural world. And Neurath also imagined that people would be able to participate in economic democracy because they would begin to see what the economy looks like. So he engaged in something called isotype, which was this graphic design to show what the economy looked like to the working classes of Vienna. And this was important because if people could see the economy, they can imagine controlling it. And we tried to do something similar in terms of Neurathian pedagogy, where we actually have a video game where you play as a planetary planner. So if you disagree with us on, say, like meat production or nuclear power, you know, we invite you and try to create your own alternative. So in the book, some people are very closely engaged with planning, and they're closely tracking regional and global plans and how their locale will fit into these broader plans, and they will represent these plans at a local parliament. And we also can imagine there will be global elections as well. And then, all these things are happening together, and lots of huge changes are happening. I mean, we imagine like a very powerful animal rights movement that is pushing for, say, a ban on fishing, for example. You know, veganism is widespread. And then there's lots of rewilding taking place. But this isn't a world that has arrived at their utopia yet. I mean, they are still dealing with the repair of, you know, centuries of capitalism. And there still will be perhaps a risk of disease or climate disaster. And, you know, one has to help climate refugees and so forth. But we think that in this society where life is collectively decided upon and people are trying to achieve ecological balance at some level with the natural world, then we will hopefully end up in a safe harbor eventually. And definitely it presents a future that is much more hopeful than the one we began with in the introduction, with disease and inequality and geoengineering.
Troy Vitese, Drew Pendergrass, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having us.
Troy Vitese is an environmental historian. Drew Pendergrass is a PhD student in environmental engineering at Harvard University. Together, they're the co-authors of Half Earth Socialism, A Plan to Save the Future from Extinction, Climate Change, and Pandemics. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org, along with a link to the video game that they mentioned. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.